You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of July 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme...
President Putin can make a huge difference here if he chooses to. And we and our European partners will take additional measures and impose wider sanctions on key sections of the Russian economy if that is what we must do.
John Kerry there. It's a day of diplomacy. From Ukraine to Gaza, we take a look at the diplomatic manoeuvrings that ambassadors, envoys and foreign ministers are making to find peaceful solutions to some very volatile situations. Two men who should know how it's done, former diplomat John Everard and The Times' diplomatic editor Roger Boys, will be here to give us their views. We'll also be in Hungary to find out why it no longer sees itself as a liberal democracy. Then, towards the end of the show, we'll hear the second chapter of Monocle's summer murder mystery.
A man was examining the serpent's head. Tall but portly, he was dressed in a polo shirt with a crocodile embroidered on the breast and linen trousers that had been expertly tailored to flatter his bulk.
All that, plus we discuss how German krautrock has influenced electronic music since the 1960s. That's Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. But before all of that, here's Bill Bingham with the latest news for around the world.
Monocle 24 News. Israel has stepped up its military campaign in Gaza, where more than 100 Palestinians have been killed on Tuesday, and oil storage tanks for the territory's only power plant have been destroyed. The Israeli military says it's targeted over 110, what it calls terror sites, by air, sea and land since midnight. The total Palestinian death toll now stands at more than 1,150. Israel has lost 53 soldiers, along with two civilians and a Thai national. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the military campaign will continue until it had achieved its aims. The United States has repeated it supports Israel's right to defend itself. But as US Secretary of State John Kerry told reporters, Washington is working to find a peaceful settlement to the crisis.
What we put on the table, in fact, allowed Israel to continue to deal with its tunnels in a short-term ceasefire to try to see if there was a way to reach a sustainable ceasefire. The UN has called for this, and Prime Minister Netanyahu himself has said that he is prepared to embrace it, providing it doesn't prejudice Israel in its way of protecting itself, and we have made certain that we guarantee that it doesn't.
Ukraine's Deputy Prime Minister says the search for bodies at the MH17 crash site has continued despite what he called provocations. The chief of the Organisation for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE, has praised the efforts of Ukraine's president in assisting the international investigation. Fierce fighting between the Ukrainian military and pro-Russian rebels had earlier forced officials to abandon plans to gain access to the crash site. The Australian and Dutch investigators had also been trying to collect the belongings of the 298 people who were killed when the Malaysia Airlines plane was shot down earlier this month. Ertugrul Apakan, the head of the OSCE Special Monitoring Mission, or SMM, says they have the backing of President Petro Poroshenko.
The president of Ukraine has instructed all institutions to be helpful to OSCE SMM, and he is closely following and he's asking us to reach to the crash site as soon as possible in order to remove the remnants of the bodies and carry out investigation by the International Task Force.
European governments have agreed new sanctions against Russia. Diplomats say Moscow's oil industry, defence sector and dual-use goods, as well as sensitive technologies, are being targeted as part of new action over the Ukraine crisis. The sanctions will be reviewed after 3 months. International aviation industry chiefs are meeting in Montreal to discuss how to avoid another MH17-style disaster. The topics they debate could have far-reaching consequences for air passengers. The conference, being held by the United Nations International Civil Aviation Organization, will examine how to more effectively avoid risks to passenger planes near conflict zones. The Nigerian city of Lagos has shut down and quarantined a hospital where a man died of Ebola in Nigeria's first recorded case of the highly infectious disease. Patrick Sawyer, a consultant for the Liberian Finance Ministry, who's in his 40s, collapsed at Lagos Airport on the 20th of July and was put into isolation at a hospital in one of the most crowded parts of Lagos. He died on Friday. Ebola has killed nearly 700 people in Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone since February. Two members of the feminist group Pussy Riot are suing the Russian government over their imprisonment for a protest in a Moscow cathedral. Maria Alyokhina and Nadezhda Tolokonikova say their prosecutions amounted to torture. They've filed a case at the European Court of Human Rights against Russia, demanding €120,000 each in damages, plus €10,000 court costs. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Bill Bingham, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. We're back after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando. London.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Hong
Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. It's 18.07 here in London, 13.07 in New York. My guests today are Roger Boys and John Everard. Roger Boys is a diplomatic editor of The Times, and John Everard is a former British ambassador. John and Roger, welcome both to the programme. The European Union has announced a new range of sanctions today against Russia. The oil industry, defence, dual-use goods and sensitive technologies are all apparently being targeted. The sanctions could also eventually bar Russian banks from access to European markets. In Washington, D.C., U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry suggested there'll be more sanctions to come from that side of the Atlantic too. Roger Boys, at last, proper sanctions, perhaps?
Well, we're getting there, aren't we? This is the so-called third tier, or we're approaching the third tier anyway. I can't help feeling that it would have been better to have had a kind of shock and awe group of sanctions right at the beginning, when the Russians marched into Crimea, really, and to get a proper sense of international shock that a piece of territory can just be grabbed and retained by force. So it's just such a shock. And now we're stumbling, you know, and now 6 months on, you know, the civilian airline has had to be shot down. They've had to, the Russians have, you know, destabilized eastern Ukraine with force. They've been shooting from across the border. And now we're just about at the point where we should have been about 6 months ago. It's been really slow, but it will have some kind of effect, I suppose. But the problem is, with sanctions, you have to separate out the impact from whether it will change Putin's behavior. And it will have an impact. It will make people unhappy within the military-industrial complex in Russia, probably, and within Gazprom. But will it change Putin's behavior? I don't think so.
John Everard, is the reason it has taken so long because European leaders in particular are quite cautious, particularly when for those countries that have either strong economic ties or rely to some extent on Russia? Or is it just that's what happens when you're trying to get 28 nations to agree?
I think there's a bit of both those factors. There is an inherent caution in the European Union, particularly where commercial interests are at stake. Getting this number of countries to agree on anything is always an uphill struggle, but this is, of course, not an easy issue in any case. That's one thing. The other reason it's taking so long is that the quickest and cleanest way of imposing sanctions on a country is through the United Nations Security Council, which can vote and can establish international law instantly that sanctions must be applied. Of course, in the case of Russia, a permanent five member of the Security Council with a veto, that simply wouldn't work. So that the normal processes, which are much quicker than this, have not been usable.
Roger, I want to in a moment come on to the question you just posed about, you know, will it make a difference? But first, let's look at the big three issues that have really sort of held up Europe. There's the money coming into London, which the Brits have been rather wary of giving up on. There's the arms deal that France has struck with Russia over the Mistral aircraft carriers. And then there's Germany's gas deals with Russia. Those are the big three issues, and yet we're not going to see much change there, are we?
Well, I mean, the reason we've come to the point where we're at is because Germany has shifted, and Germany has sort of realized that it can't become the slowest boat in the convoy just because it's so massively dependent on Russian gas.
But shifted enough, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I don't know where the end point is in this. I think at the moment it's not threatening anything, you know, any great collapse in supplies. And, you know, and unfortunately, in a way, it's the summer and we're not talking about, winter shortages or anything like that. And the French, of course, this is completely unacceptable that they're still thinking that they can sell helicopter carriers to Russia. I don't really see why they can't suspend this sale. I don't see why some of these sanctions can't be made time sensitive and conditional on Putin's change of behavior. So I don't see why some of these French warships can't be just held in dock for another 2 years.
And John Everett, on the point that Roger raised before about, you know, will this actually have an impact? It's, you know, we've already seen a slight impact on the Russian economy. But I mean, can you see these sanctions and the sanctions that might come from the US having any sort of impact compared to, for example, the sanctions on the Iranian economy?
Yes, I can. I think there's a tendency to talk down the effect the sanctions have already had on Russian behavior. When the first batch of sanctions were announced, the European Union said that they were closely targeted. And everybody went, poo-poo, that's just what you say if you're being feeble. In fact, by picking on things that hurt people close to Putin, they clearly have had an effect on Russian behavior. Putin has not invaded Ukraine. He has been ineffective in supporting the separatist rebels. He could have done a lot more, but I think it's been held back by important forces within Moscow. So, yes, it does affect things. Can I just pick up another point?
Sure.
The big three, you said, the France, Germany and the UK. France, I agree entirely with what Roger says. Germany is clearly in a quandary. The quandary, I think, is being resolved to a large extent because of the messages that are now reached in Berlin very firmly from The Hague. The Netherlands is absolutely incandescent over what has happened. And this has a big effect in Europe. The British supposed reluctance to impose sanctions that might affect Russian money flows into the city of London, I think, to be honest, is being overdone. There was a famous moment earlier in this process where somebody flashed a document at a press photographer, one of the oldest tricks in the book, before you go into a meeting in Downing Street saying we don't want to do this because the economy is going to be hurt. But since that moment, I don't think there's any solid evidence at all that Cameron's government has held back in sanctions in an effort to protect the city. On the contrary, I think the UK has been at the forefront of pressing for stronger sanctions within the EU.
Roger, on that point, go on.
I mean, you've also got to calculate in the unintended consequences of sanctions, the capital flight from Russia, and also the disdain of the Chinese, you know, the sense in China that Russia is becoming an unstable place, a wobbly partner. All this has an impact on the Russian economy. So even though sometimes the measures do seem a bit, minor, the actual spread of
when taken together, it can
the
have
spread
a bigger
through
impact.
The markets. Yes, it's a very it's very easy to destroy market confidence in Russia at the moment, and that's what's happening. And that's in a way helped Cameron, because you don't have to be too specific about blocking credit lines for Russia. A lot of this is happening anyway. There's a lot of distrust in Russian investment at the moment.
Let's mention China, John, because as Roger's mentioned there, because this isn't just the West versus Putin. It's China's relationship with Russia has clearly been affected, hasn't it, impacted by what's happened over the past few months.
Yes, it certainly has. I agree entirely with what Roger has said, that China will be concluding that Russia is unstable and China doesn't like unstable things. China will also probably be concluding that Russia is weak, that if you are going to foment this kind of rebellion in a neighbouring state, you play to win. And Russia is not winning right now. I mean, we seem to be approaching some kind of stalemate. Perhaps we can talk about that in a bit. The fact that Putin was forced to go to China virtually on his knees begging for support. Remember the famous gas deal where still now we don't know at which price that gas is to be sold, but almost certainly at a price heavily favourable to China. China will have seen that too as a sign of weakness.
Roger, when we talk about diplomacy in this situation, we've been talking mainly about sanctions, about economic sanctions. But in terms of diplomats sitting down and talking about how to solve this crisis in Ukraine, has that taken a back foot, or do you think there are going to be opportunities in the coming weeks and months for key figures, whether that's people from Europe or the US, to sit down with Russia and Ukraine to try and find a diplomatic solution here?
Well, my bet is that what we'll see in the next 2 weeks is an escalation from Russia. When the airliner was shot down, we thought, aha, Putin's going to have to take a step back, which will mean probably gently letting those separatists go and reaching some kind of accommodation with the Ukrainian government. Well, of course, that was just starry-eyed Western guff, but what we'll probably see in the next 2 weeks, I think, is an escalation from the Russian side. I'm just discussing with John earlier that they seem to be in the Donetsk Republic putting their own placemen, even tougher and more rigid placemen, into power there so that they can keep proper control over Donetsk, because they can see the Ukrainian army moving in closer and closer at a shocking pace for the Russians. And only when that plays its way out, only then, when it looks particularly perilous, will the Russians actually make themselves indispensable for a diplomatic deal of some kind. So I think there's a bit of diplomatic foreplay at the moment, but overwhelmingly between the EU and America, because America's been complaining that the EU is not keeping up, that it's that it's too laggardly with all of this, and then there's been a little bit of interplay between the French and the British, arms sanctions for city sanctions, and there's been a bit French-German, and so on. So that's the level of diplomatic play at the moment. It's not very persuasive, and it's not very impressive. And in a way, Putin still has the initiative, because we need him. It seems that we need him for a deal, and he is not offering us a deal. He's offering us more violence, and that's probably how it's going to play out for the next couple of weeks. We will reach some kind of deal. After all, Putin is going to have to accept that there's a legitimate government in Ukraine at some stage, but it's going to take a while.
John, you're shaking your head at that.
Yes.
At the idea that there will be a deal.
I would love to believe that a deal could be reached. I frankly doubt it. I agree, Roger. I mean, Putin is doubling down. Instead of taking the opportunity of severing his links with the separatists after MH17, instead he's strengthening his links with them. And as he does so, doing things like firing artillery from Russian territory onto targets in Ukraine, he is inculpating Russia even more deeply in the quagmire of eastern Ukraine. A deal implies some kind of common ground. It's very hard to see that there is any. I mean, Russia, as you said earlier, has seized illegally a chunk of Ukraine's territory, Crimea. It is trying to destabilize other parts of Ukraine territory. The only basis on which you could bring this fighting to an end, it seems to me, is for Russia to stop doing these things. There's likely to be a military rather than diplomatic solution.
John Everard, Roger Boys, we'll leave it there. For just a moment, we'll be talking more diplomacy or hopes for diplomacy or fears that there may be no diplomacy when we turn our attention to Israel and Gaza in just a moment.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight.
For Monocle in Istanbul, I'm Joseph Dana.
For Monocle in Jordan, I'm Nigel Wilson.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Tristan McAllister.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Brown.
For Monocle in Accra, I'm Jocelyn Edwards.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv, I'm Marika Peters.
From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in San Francisco, I'm Alistair G.
For Monocle in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delorme.
For Monocle in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Megan Dietry.
For Monocle in Igualada, I'm Lee Mulders.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. My guests today are John Everard and Roger Boys. Let's turn our attention now to Gaza, where despite the attempts of John Kerry, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, and who knows who else behind the scenes, there is still no ceasefire and no diplomatic solution on the cards at all. Roger Boys, what does the international community, to use that very loose term, do now when basically both sides don't seem to want to talk?
Well, I think I think Israel is controlling the pace of events and the pace of action. I think, you know, the dismal response that John Kerry's ceasefire proposals got from Israel shows that actually the international community is pretty relevant at the moment. What they will come in at some stage, because at some stage the shooting will stop, and then Israel's going to be settled with the problem of what to do with Gaza. The question is, of course, how far it's demilitarized, how far Hamas itself is defanged, whether some kind of arrangement can be reached with the present structure of Gaza. All that will require some kind of international support, I think. But it's all up for grabs. And Israel, at the moment, does still, even though it's got international opinion, you know, wildly against it, because of all the killings in Palestine, in the Gaza, does still feel it's got two advantages. One, it's got the Iron Dome, anti-missile defense system, which has allowed it to dictate the pace of this war right from the beginning, because it's so minimized Israeli civilian casualties that it has almost no domestic pressure within Israel to change course, and allows it all sorts of political room for maneuver as well as military. And the other is that the Arab Straits, unlike other Gaza incursions in the past, are actually very skeptical about Hamas. Not just Egypt, but now Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates. So we're getting a situation where only Turkey and Qatar are really explainers of Hamas activities, and only they are actually getting telephone calls in to Hamas leaders. And since Qatar has just had a succession and is bankrolling Hamas and maybe having second doubts, there may be some opening when the fighting is over for some kind of arrangement whereby
Gaza could perhaps, prosper and Hamas be demilitarized and defanged so that it doesn't become a problem. And but, you know, we're quite away from that.
Indeed. And John Everard, this is, you know, one of the reasons why this feels so different from 2012, from 2008, where we've been here before, is that the situation in the Arab world, as Roger says, has changed. Egypt, even under Mubarak, was at least sort of willing to be, it didn't have the hatred for Hamas that Sisi clearly has. There were people within the region, and you'd be hearing the Arab League making very strong statements. This was obviously pre-Arab Spring, when the Arab League was still relatively secure in its standing, would be making very strong statements about what was going on in Palestine, how terrible it was. We've heard very, very little, haven't we, from Arab leaders?
Yes, that's right. I think you're right to put your finger on this very important difference between this outburst of violence and previous ones. I think, you know, the Iron Dome is the other big difference. Israel is no longer so vulnerable to Hamas's rockets. The third big difference, seems to me, is the unanimity of the Israeli cabinet. I mean, in previous conflicts, we've seen a lot of dissent from within the Israeli leadership. This time, they appear to be pretty much united, including people who traditionally have been quite dovish on Gaza.
And that's partly, of course, because over the last decade or so, what counts for a dove in Israel has, you know, those people have pretty much disappeared.
Well, that's right. I mean, Israeli politics as a whole has shifted to the right. That is another important factor. At the moment, I think we have to say that the chances of a negotiated peace between Hamas and Israel are not good. Kerry's plan is quite clearly going nowhere. Everybody has ripped it to shreds. Israel in the most violent terms. Now, even if the diplomatic machine of the United States could go into superdrive and produce another plan, you would be talking probably a week, maybe 2 weeks before this ever came to light, because you need to consult everybody involved, and this takes time. And the way things are going right now, in that kind of time span, Israel is going to impose a military solution on the situation.
Roger, you mentioned that, you know, international opinion is obviously very opposed to Israel, and they don't seem too worried by that. For some in Israel, the fact that everyone's against them is a note of pride. If we go back to Israel's war in Lebanon in 2006, there was a lot of, you know, the amount of international anger towards what Israel was doing rose quite substantially during that. It became a political issue in here in this country, in the UK, when Tony Blair was almost forced to resign as prime minister. It was also to do with internal Labour Party politics, but partly because of his stance on Lebanon. And that eventually did have some impact in Israel, didn't it? What do you think has changed?
Well, you know, it's not that Israel is completely immune from international pressure. That this will, you know, something will play out in this way. I think where international pressure will be registered is in the day one after the shooting is ended. It could be that Israel unilaterally then at some stage decides it's not going to fight anymore. And at that point, Gaza has to be rethought. And at that point, international factors come into play. So, you know, the question, as you say, the cabinet is behind Bibi Netanyahu, but they're not necessarily united on what should happen to Gaza. Should it be reoccupied, for example? You know, should it be run basically by an Israeli governorate that uses its period of 6 or 8 months of governance of Gaza to root out the last of Hamas and to rebuild some of the things that they've destroyed? Power station was destroyed the other night, for example. Will it go down that route? And in which case, do we support that? Are we going to be invited to support that? Another idea that's floating in Israel is that a little bit on the model of how we took away the Syrian chemical weapons, and into some kind of international grouping or force would disarm or or at least downgrade the remnants of Hamas, and that Palestinian Authority and EU could perhaps monitor the border crossings and so on. There are all these sort of ideas floating around, all of which involve some kind of international consensus and Western consensus above all. It involves agreement within the Israeli cabinet. And
of course, in Gaza as well.
And in Gaza, and a military victory, you know.
Well, just before we go, before we came on air, Roger, you were mentioning that you couldn't remember a summer like this where so much has happened. I was going to say, why do you think that is? But, I mean, how does it compare to... to previous years? Are there any other historical moments where you can think, actually, there was a summer where it was this bad?
I can't, for the life of me. I mean, there have been difficult years when things have come together. 1979 was quite a difficult year. 56 with Suez and the Hungarian Revolution, but that was in October. But of course, the August was when it was all beginning with Nasser. Of course, you can grab these. 1968 was a difficult year for different reasons. You know, there are all sorts of complexities and coagulations of crises that are going on at the moment. And some people say, you know, there's a monolithic explanation, monocausal explanation, which is the weakness of U.S. power and the weakness of the Obama administration, and that is one of the common linkages. Why we didn't arm the Syrian rebels earlier, for example, allowing ISIS to come in, and you know, these kind of, and the reflected and pseudo strength of Putin as a result of the weakness of the international weakness of Obama.
John Everard, would you say those are fair reasons why we're experiencing such a volatile summer?
Yes, I think those reasons are valid. I think there are random factors too, that crises have a habit of just erupting at inconvenient moments, and by statistics, at some years, you're going to get several together. Previous years, I can't help thinking, I wasn't around at the time, but summer 1914 probably felt a bit like this.
Well, there we are. That's a note to end on. Let's hope it doesn't go any further than that. John Everard and Roger Boys, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. In the second half hour, we're going to be in Hungary to hear what's happening there. We're also going to have a bit of review of some great German rock music. That's not an oxymoron. And we'll also hear the second episode of our summer murder mystery. But first, here's Bill Bingham with the news headlines.
Israel has stepped up its military campaign in Gaza, where more than 100 Palestinians have been killed on Tuesday, and oil storage tanks for the territory's only power plant have been destroyed. Israeli military says it's targeted over 110 what it calls terror sites by air, sea and land since midnight. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the campaign will continue until it had achieved its aims. Fierce fighting between the Ukrainian military and pro-Russian rebels has forced officials to abandon plans to gain access to the crash site. The Australian and Dutch investigators have also been trying to collect the belongings of the 298 people who were killed when the Malaysia Airlines plane was shot down earlier this month. European governments have agreed new sanctions against Russia. Diplomats say Moscow's oil industry, defence sector and dual-use goods, as well as sensitive technologies, are being targeted as part of new action over the Ukraine crisis. And international aviation industry chiefs are meeting in Montreal to discuss how to avoid another MH17-style disaster. The topics they debate could have far-reaching consequences for air passengers. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Bill Bingham, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Time now for us to head to Budapest, where our correspondent Adam Labor has all the week's latest news. Adam, welcome to Midori House. Let's start with Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. Now, some people would say that this man has never really seen Hungary as a liberal democracy, and now he's come out and said it.
Yes, he gave a speech in Romania over the weekend to many thousands of young ethnic Hungarians who live in Romania. And it's caused a huge stir here because basically he said that Hungary will be a democracy, but it won't be a liberal democracy. It'll be a new kind of democracy which will be based on work and the kind of the nation in Hungary and the Hungarian nation beyond the borders, essentially.
And what does that mean? Does that mean there will still be elections and there'll still be a free press, but we will just do things in a different way, or is there more to it than this?
Well, of course, there'll still be elections. There'll still be a free press. I mean, Hungary's not going to become China, but what it means is the kind of the social direction of the country is becoming much more conservative and much more centralized, and critics say, we're starting to see tinges of authoritarianism here as well, although the government denies that. But I mean, it's a very clear message when the Prime Minister of a European member state and democracy gives a speech speaking admiringly about China and Turkey and Singapore, which are not countries with shining human rights records, then it sort of tells you what direction he's looking at. He's been talking for quite a while about, the strong wind blowing from the east, saying the Western welfare state model is broken. And in his defense, a lot of people say that as well, that there simply isn't the money. All countries are facing welfare and pension crises, and he thinks the answer is more the Eastern model.
And whatever the criticism may be of him, both inside Hungary and outside, no one can argue that he is quite popular at the moment and his opponents are struggling to make themselves heard.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the most remarkable things, really, is that there's been, 4 years of sustained criticism of the government from the EU, from the European Commission, from human rights organizations, from the State Department, from embassies and ambassadors, that the country is heading in the wrong direction, it's over-centralized, that independent institutions have been taken over by the party. And basically, it's had zero impact on Fidesz, the ruling party's electoral results or prospects, really. I mean, they lost some votes in the last election in April, but the reorganized electoral system yet again delivered them another two-thirds majority. And there's no doubt that they are the most powerful political leading force in the country.
And when you look at recent polls, the problem for the left in Hungary isn't even how do we take on Fidesz, how do we take on Viktor Orban, it's can we even come second?
Yes, exactly. The second most party is the far-right party, Jobbik, which in fact has slightly moved to the centre away from the real wild extremism of 3 or 4 years ago and has moderated its rhetoric a bit. And it seems to be working. It's looking at around 15-16% support, whereas the socialists have 12%. But that's partly because there are, in fact, like four left-wing parties. So if you add up all the four left-wing parties, then you do get to around 20%, something like that. So you're beating Jobbik. But there's still an overwhelming right-wing slash far-right majority in Hungary. The left is a hopeless case at the moment.
And Adam, just finally to turn to the state of the Hungarian economy, it has been boosted somewhat this year by really quite large growth, double-digit growth in the housing market, in property.
Yes, there's been something like a 35% year-on-year increase in property investments, something like €300 million coming in, some to residential and some to commercial, partly because it was such a low base last year and partly because flats are still comparatively cheap in Budapest. For €100,000, you can still get a decent, easily, a very nice, decent two-bedroom apartment. You can get a one-bedroom for, €50,000-60,000. Might not be in the best part of town, but it's certainly absolutely livable. So it's a low base. The market has hardly moved in the last 10 years, and it seems that people are starting to notice that. Also, it might be some money. People are saying that money is coming in from the Arab Spring and from the former Soviet Union, investors that don't have the money to buy in London or New York or Paris and are looking for a foothold in Europe, but somewhere a bit cheaper and perhaps a bit nearer to home.
Well, indeed, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, how much of this is actually, you know, Hungarians that are investing in property that are that feel that the economy is strong enough for them to perhaps, you know, buy a three-bedroom house rather than a two-bedroom house, compared to how much of it is people looking to invest from abroad?
We don't have the precise breakdown of it, but there's definitely money coming in from abroad. And as I say, the more unstable countries like Greece and Italy have seen an influx of money coming in from there, also from the Arab countries and from the former Soviet Union. So there is definitely foreign money coming in, tends to buy more of the high-end properties, which is, you know, boost the market up.
Adam Labor in Budapest, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Up next, we return to that mystical Greek island for part two of a Mediterranean murder mystery story. Stay tuned.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now, Monocle's summer newspaper, Mediterraneo, or Mediterraneo, depending on however you want to say it, is now on a newsstand near you. If you're a subscriber, you would have received it weeks ago. That's how good it is to be a subscriber. Among the many highlights contained therein is a murder mystery by Anne Zarudi, author of the Hermes Diaktoros series of detective novels. For Monocle Mediterraneo, she wrote an exclusive tale, Murder Mystery in the Isles. Here is chapter two.
Murder Mystery in the Isles by Anne Zarudi. In a house on a Greek island, a man lies seriously ill in bed, tended to by his aunt. Meanwhile, a mysterious man arrives in town to visit an ancient shrine and drink the spring waters. But the water has stopped flowing, and soon the man's investigations reveal that there are turbulent depths beneath the island's calm surface.
Papa Lefteris left his black hat on the seat of his car and followed the rough path away from the road. Crickets rasped under bushes of sage and thyme. The hillside dropped away to a sea of cerulean blue, where a solitary yacht had raised its sail. The chapel of St. Marina was aged and primitive. 4 whitewashed walls beneath a curving roof. Shaded by pine trees, its stone-paved courtyard was open to the breezes off the sea. Pots of holy basil and scarlet geraniums were arranged around the door. Behind the chapel, a marble bowl and stone serpent's head were set in a wall. Water had once run from the serpent's mouth, but the bowl was dry and empty now, except for a few fallen pine cones. A man was examining the serpent's head. Tall but portly, he was dressed in a polo shirt with a crocodile embroidered on the breast and linen trousers that had been expertly tailored to flatter his bulk. His greying hair was unconventionally long, and his eyes were hidden behind sunglasses with an Italian designer's logo on the arms. On his feet were old-fashioned white canvas shoes of the style once worn for tennis. In his hand, he carried a leather holdall of the type favoured by sportsmen. As Papa Lefteris approached the chapel doorway, the fat man moved to greet him. "Yassas," he said, holding out his hand. Papa Lefteris put down the bottles of water he was carrying. "Hermes Diaktoros of Athens," said the fat man, speaking in the beautifully enunciated Greek of television news presenters. Papa Lefteris introduced himself and shook the fat man's hand. I was here a number of years ago, said the fat man, and I've come back to drink the waters from the spring. You probably know that in ancient times this place was sacred to Panacea, goddess of medicines and salves. The serpent, of course, was sacred to Panacea's father, Asclepius, god of healing. The waters are supposed to be cure-alls, everything from blindness to gout. I didn't know that, said the priest. This church is dedicated to Saint Marina. The fat man smiled. Patron saint against the plague, he said. One merges into another. The water doesn't flow here anymore, said Papa Lefteris. He unscrewed the cap from one of the bottles he had brought with him and began to water the geraniums, but paused, after a moment, to show the fat man the label. Blue as the sea below, a stylized yacht in full sail. This is the same water. We diverted the spring to bottle it at a place just down the road. It's only a very small operation. 1,000 half-litre bottles a week. But we thought it would be an excellent way of raising funds. We? The church. The Archbishop and I. Funds for what? We support an Orthodox ministry for prisons in Florida. Faith, not felony. The fat man raised his eyebrows. So now you pipe away Panacea's water and carry it back to care for her shrine? St. Marina's shrine. Chapel. The priest emptied one of his bottles onto a pot of flourishing basil. And how have the people reacted to your siphoning off the spring water and selling back to them what used to be free? Papa Lefteris brushed a fly from the front of his grey robe. I think they appreciate our motivation, he said. It's in a good cause, after all. But I'm sorry you've had a wasted journey. Can I offer you a lift somewhere? Oh, my journeys are rarely wasted, said the fat man. But yes, I'd appreciate a lift. It's a long walk down to the port. Papa Lefteris led the way back to the road and held open the passenger door for the fat man to climb in. You have a beautiful car, said the fat man, settling into his seat and placing his holdall in the footwell. He ran his hand over the dashboard. And almost new. The priest reached into a case of water on the back seat and offered the fat man a bottle. Please, take one of these, he said. It seems only fair since you have come away thirsty from the spring. The fat man opened the water and, as Papa Lefteris started the engine, took a drink. It's not as I remember it, he said, tucking the bottle into his holdall. Water that has known only sky, earth, and rock will never be the same as water that's known machinery and plastic. The priest drove cautiously, slowing almost to a walking pace for the hair-raising bends in the road where the land fell away in precipitous slopes at the edge of the carriageway. These roads are dangerous, said the fat man. And I appreciate the care you're taking. Though, with a car like this, your care's understandable. Forgive me for asking, Papa, but on a priest's salary, how did you afford it? Our business partner arranged it through the company. I need something reliable if the operation's to run smoothly. The church has a business partner? We can't afford to be dinosaurs, said the priest shortly. I bring a certain expertise. Before I took my vows, I was an engineer. But in the modern world, we can't rely on the acumen of men who know only prayers and liturgy. Can't you rely on your God? Papa Lefteris gave a tight smile. God is timeless, he said, but even he must move with the times.
Murder Mystery in the Isles was performed by Karen Cogan and written by Anne Zarudi. It's an original drama produced for Monocle 24 by Paul Noble.
There we are, and of course you can hear the full story on our website, monocle.com. mediterraneo.com, or of course read it all in Mediterraneo, which is on sale now. Now, I'm assuming you know Kraftwerk, the electro pioneers who revolutionised German music in the 1970s, but they weren't the only band that used the landscape of post-war Germany for experimental sounds. What became known as Krautrock has influenced all genres, from post-punk to electronica and ambient. The music writer David Stubbs is the author of Future Days, Krautrock and the Building of Future Germany, and he joins us now. David, welcome to Midori House.
Hi, it's me.
Now, tell us, what impact has... firstly, what impact did politics and post-war Germany have on music in the country?
Well, actually, I mean, it had a significant impact on what was actually only a tiny minority of musicians at the time. But all of them were driven by the idea that in order for Germany to kind of renew culturally, it had to kind of reject this kind of Anglo-American... model of music making, and Anglo-American rock, which was dominating in Germany at the time, because obviously that's what a lot of young kids wanted to listen to, but also it was the favoured music of American and UK soldiers that were stationed in Germany at the time. And I think there was this significant handful of musicians who felt that this is almost a kind of cultural occupation. You know, we are on occupied land culturally as a result of this. This is almost like a cultural Marshall Plan or whatever. And that in order to kind of really begin again culturally, we need to sort of create new sort of variations on rock and popular music from scratch.
And then did it essentially then turn the other way and the music that was created have an impact on German society and German culture and politics more broadly than these small groups of people that were creating this?
Well, you see, that's the ironic thing. It actually was pretty much disregarded in Germany itself at the time. And in fact, Germany has tended to lag behind in subsequent generations in terms of krautrock appreciation. It actually first got a wider hearing and a sort of fuller critical appreciation in France initially, then in the UK, and then later on America and the rest of the world. It's like one of the chats from Alan Dulles says in there, a prophet is not without honour save in his own country. It's one of the great ironies of the thing, because really it was a very German phenomenon. I mean, what krautrock does is it's typical really of a kind of German spirit. There's a kind of age-old thing really of construction, of reinvention, all these kinds of things. But its real influence, in fact, wasn't so much on German society. German society actually, its building, its rebuilding, kind of was running parallel, really, with the sort of regenerative force of krautrock. But krautrock's influence, as you said earlier on, has been immense.
Let's hear a little bit of it. We'll save the most well known for last. We're going to play a track by a group called Can. Before we do, tell us a little bit about them.
Well, Can formed in Cologne, and their ethos, they were all actually highly trained musicians, but it wasn't like the kind of prog musicians of the time in the UK and people like that who showed off their virtuosity. They had a kind of ethos, a way of playing in which each kind of enabled the other. As the drummer Jackie Liebeside put it, no Führers, no leaders. It was actually quite an important thing that they reconfigure the shape of what a rock band should be. I mean, they had drums, they had guitars, keyboards, vocals, but they're all kind of arranged in a bizarrely sort of different kind of spatial way, a much more open-ended way.
So not drums at the back, singer at the front, and...
Well, I mean, obviously, physically, they were kind of all but in the mix, as it were, the way that one relates to the other, yeah.
Okay, let's hear a bit of it. This is Can with Future Days. There with Future Days. It's there's a little bit of Talking Heads in that, isn't there? You can sort of see how
Talking Heads were very influenced by Can.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's, you can see, you know, from that sort of the influence that, you know, even if we haven't, most of us haven't heard of this band now, how they influenced others outside of Germany that became very well known indeed.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, Talking Heads are a classic example. Can did what they call their ethnological forgery series, in which they kind of took sort of various ethnic musics and did these kind of deliberate sort of pastiches of them. And that sort of prefigures, very ironically, things like world music, which also was a kind of a bit of a touchstone for people like Talking Heads. But yeah, there is this kind of airy, sort of weightless, funky sort of thing almost going on with someone like Can.
Let's now hear Neu with an exclamation mark,
yes,
proving just how new they are. This is Hal Gallo.
Hello.
Neu with Hallo Gallo. David, tell us about Neu.
Well, what you've got there is that ding, 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 this 4-4 beat, which is known as Motorik or Dinger beat, named after Klaus Dinger, the drummer, which Brian Eno cites as one of the most significant rhythmical influences of the 1970s. It's something you hear quite a lot. You hear it later on in the music of Stereolab, who are very influenced by Neu, and Stereolab themselves are hugely influential, and you hear it sort of echoed in sort of more up-to-date groups like the Horrors and people like that. It's got this kind of wonderful linear quality to it. You know, the songs that are based around the 4-4 beat that don't tend to go into kind of verse and chorus. It's just like unfills in a very sort of picaresque, linear, ribbon-like sort of way, sort of onto the distant horizon. It's an example of the way that krautrock and the bands within that sort of term reconfigured the sort of very shape of rock and pop songs.
Do you feel, when you were writing this book, did you feel that this was just a story that had been forgotten, that, or that perhaps wasn't even known outside of Germany, or certainly outside of certain small circles?
Well, I was struck actually by the number of people who I knew who didn't really know very much at all about krautrock, where to begin with it really. And there was even a radio DJ was quite erudite and sort of, well versed in music, and it surprised me. But when somebody mentioned the krautrock briefly, they said, "Oh, you mean like Rammstein?" And went, Rammstein, you know. And
at least they didn't mention David Hasselhoff.
No, that's right. And it is one of. It's a slightly contested term, and it's a very contentious term as well. And one of the first things to do in the book is discuss, you know, the semantics of the word krautrock and whatever, and actually how most of the bands that are kind of, you know, saddled with this particular sort of genre, you know, obviously reject it but outright. And, you know, if you said to Kraftwerk, "Oh, you're a krautrock band," aren't you? You know, they throw you out of the room. And yes, I do think that there is such a thing as krautrock as a kind of general philosophy that all of these bands, even though they were very, very diverse, had in common, a common sort of set of properties.
There we are. David Stups, thank you very much for coming in. The book is called Future Days, Krautrock and the Building of Future Germany. And since you just mentioned Kraftwerk, we should play a little bit of them. This is Autobahn. There we are. That was Kraftwerk with Autobahn. And that's all we've got time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Roger Boys and John Everard. Midori House was produced by Isabel Kayser, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Chiara Rimella. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. The news is next. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. That was Midori House.
Goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.